Tests should be available to all who need them. And the government should stop at nothing to make that happen. We must know the true extent of this outbreak so we can map it, trace it, and contain it.
Former Vice President and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden speaking today about the novel coronavirus, or COVID-19. But the government's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, told lawmakers today our system is not set up to rapidly distribute the tests.
It is a failing. I mean, let's admit it. The fact is, the way the system was set up is that the public health component that Dr. Redfield was talking about was a system where you put it out there in the public and a physician asks for it and you get it. The idea of anybody getting it easily, the way people in other countries are doing it, we're not set up for that. Do I think we should be? Yes, but we're not.
There's a lot of confusion out there. Who gets the test? Who orders it? How do you get it if you want it? Earlier, I spoke with a man named Jesse. He asked us not to use his last name. He works at an architecture firm here in L.A. And about 2 weeks ago, he met with a client who later tested positive for COVID-19. Jesse then tried to get tested himself, and he told me what happened next. So you tried to get tested yesterday, right?
That's correct.
What happened?
So I first called the L.A. County Department of Public Health and was routed through to a number that was disconnected. I called a second time and explained that I had been in contact with someone who had tested positive for the virus, and I was put through to a voicemail. I called a third time, got a little more pushy and agitated, and was put through to someone who introduced themselves as being with the Office of Communicable Diseases, and explained that I had come in direct contact about 2 weeks ago with someone who now has tested positive and asked, what should I do? Should I be tested? Should the people that work around me be tested? Should the people in my office building be tested? What about all, you know, my family members, my spouse, all those people? And essentially, the person I spoke to said, we can't really help you. We don't deal with the general public. We don't recommend testing at this point unless you're sick or presenting symptoms, and you should call your doctor. And that was sort of the end of the conversation. So I called my primary care physician, and my conversation with her was really helpful, but she basically said the same thing. If you're not sick, if you're not presenting symptoms, even if you've had direct contact with someone, we're not recommending testing right now, or we're not able to prescribe that for you.
So then what did you do?
Well, really nothing at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially what the person at the public health office told me, what a family member who's a physician told me, and what the representative at my doctor's office told me was, there's really nothing you can do at this point that if you're not presenting symptoms and if you're not sick, you're probably not going to be able to get a test.
Did they recommend self-quarantine, that you stay out of the office for a week or two?
They did, but not very emphatically. You know, the tone to me seemed to be, well, if you're not sick by now, you're probably not going to get sick. If you can isolate, it can't hurt. And wash your hands, use Purell, stay away from people, try not to, you know, share food or kiss people on the cheeks and that kind of thing. So it was kind of shocking how unclear the direction was and how casual it seems to be.
And what is your fear? That even though you're not presenting symptoms, you could still communicate the disease to others?
That's right. You know, I'm healthy. I'm in my early 40s. My spouse is healthy and a little younger than I am. But I've been in contact with a lot of people since then, a lot of other people that I work with, a lot of family members, some of whom are elderly. I've been in restaurants and Starbucks and the bank. And now I'm assuming, since I'm not sick, that I'm a low risk in terms of transmitting it if I did contract it. But I could have personally spread this to dozens of people just myself.
Mm-hmm. What about your client who did test positive? What happened to that person?
That person is receiving medical treatment. They're expected to make full recovery. As far as I know, they had not traveled to a country that would be considered high risk. I can't say for sure, but I'm assuming that they got it through community spread.
So as you're pondering this and your direct experience with all this, And I know you're not a public health official or a doctor or anyone involved in the medical field, but what is your sense about how this virus is spreading or could spread or how we as a culture are responding to it?
It's hard to say. You know, I think I felt like people were overreacting and panicking and in ways that seemed a little irrational. You know, I think for the vast majority of people, it's going to be something that you can recover from. It's going to be unpleasant and a disruption, but it's not going to be, you know, fatal. But I'm not sure. You know, I have some friends who are extremely paranoid about it and have quarantined themselves and their children, and they're stockpiling food and toilet paper and medicines and Purell. But, you know, it's funny. Some of the people that I told that I had been exposed to this, and I've since spent a lot of time with them, and now they've been exposed, were sort of not terribly freaked out by it, which kind of surprised me, you know. And some of those people are high risk, elderly people. So in my opinion, it's so unclear right now what you're supposed to do, how it's spreading, and how far it's going to spread. I felt so unclear after all my phone calls and conversations yesterday about, should I be more panicked? Am I overly panicked? Should I be notifying more people that I came in casual contact with? Or am I then just spreading hysteria? It's really scary. You don't know the right thing to do. You don't know if you should err on the side of caution. I certainly don't want to call every person I've had a casual interaction with and panic them when it's considered extraordinarily low risk. But then I feel like, is that completely irresponsible on my part?
So how will you modify your behavior going forward if you'll modify your behavior? Are you going to change where you go?
Well,
will you stop going out to restaurants? Anything like that?
I think a little bit. I think, you know, obviously my husband and I talked a little bit about it, and I think we're going to do the same things everyone else is doing. What few public gatherings are still remaining, I think we'll avoid things like that. We'll probably avoid seeing our parents, who are all baby boomers in their 70s and for a little while. But, you know, I think we're just going to try and do all the things that everyone's recommending, you know, staying away from people, not shaking hands, not hugging. We'll probably stay away from things like movie theaters and maybe restaurants. You know, we have a trip booked in a few weeks. I'm not sure if we're going to take the trip. So I think everyone's going to be paralyzed and sort of shut down soon.
Yeah. Life is upside down for most of us these days.
Yeah.
Jesse,
yeah.
Thank you for speaking with us and sharing
Sure.
your story. Really appreciate
Sure.
it.
Sure. It was my pleasure.
Well, if you're confused about coronavirus testing, you are not alone. The Trump administration promised that millions of tests were being sent out and that everyone who wanted to get tested would be able to. But as we just heard, that's not true. Here in California, nearly 1,200 people have been tested. Governor Gavin Newsom says California has nearly 8,000 test kits, and he admits it's not enough.
So we'll go from 4 to potentially 7 hospital sites as early as next week, in addition to Quest, which will go from 1 testing facility in San Juan Capistrano to 2 additional testing facilities, we hope, by the end of the month. So I'm giving you a broad overview of our testing protocols, testing capacity. They are improving, but there's still challenges, and we need to own up to that, and we need to be forthright and honest about what those are.
Well, joining us to talk about testing is Janet Hamilton, Senior Director of Policy and Science at the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists. She is an epidemiologist. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So you just heard the governor admit that they don't have enough test kits. They have about 8,000 or so. What would be the right amount of test kits for a state as large as California?
Trying to predict the exact number of tests is not easy to do. And what we want to do is make sure that we do have tests available for those that need to be tested. There are a host of factors that come into play when you think about the total number of tests that you might need versus the tests that you actually need. And part of that information has to be how much disease is actually within the population and which individuals also need to be tested.
Well, how would you know how much is in the population if you haven't tested them?
That's a good question. And that's one of the things that public health surveillance or public health epidemiologists, also known as disease detectives, are looking at right now. And laboratory testing, as I mentioned, is a critical component of really being able to determine that. You can also make some very good estimates based on knowing the total number of people that you have tested and their results and applying that then to the population. Just like with influenza surveillance, we don't necessarily test every single person, but we are able to make really good estimates about the total number of people that have become infected.
We just heard from a man named Jesse, who is in contact with someone who later tested positive for COVID-19. Jesse himself doesn't have symptoms, or he doesn't have them yet. He tried to get tested and was turned away. He couldn't get tested. Should someone like him be tested, someone who is asymptomatic but who was in contact with someone who had the disease?
You know, unfortunately, the test that we have, it's not a predictive test. So it doesn't indicate whether you may later become sick. It's a test that detects whether or not you are or are not infected. So asking to be tested before you have any symptoms really won't give you the information that you very likely would want to have.
But can't you spread the disease? Can't you be infected with COVID-19 and not have the symptoms and still spread it?
Yes, you can actually be asymptomatic. But again, trying to determine when to be tested in that course, you do actually have to be exposed. Your body has to have time to develop the infection, and that is when then the test can detect it. Mm. So it can detect asymptomatic infections, but if you're trying to be tested so close to when you've actually been exposed, the disease just isn't present in your body yet, even if later you may develop disease. I think it's also important for people to remember that one of the most important things that you can really do is stay home if you are sick or developing symptoms. And we want to ensure that the most critically ill individuals can be appropriately tested and can receive the appropriate care. And when you have a lot of individuals who aren't that sick who are asking to get tested, you may actually be diverting resources from those that need it most. And that's a great opportunity for us as Americans to think about not just what our own information needs are, but the health of our communities.
Well, I think Jesse's frustration was not that he was worried that he was going to get sick, but that he was going to spread it to older people, even if he wasn't showing signs of the disease. And that, you know, it shouldn't be a question perhaps of limited resources when it comes to testing, that there should be enough resources for everyone to be tested. And why isn't that the case?
Limited testing supplies, I mean, that's a challenge. And I think we'll see more and more tests coming online and becoming available. I also think it's really important, as I mentioned before, for people to remember, though, that it's not just wanting to be tested, but the resources, humans that need to collect those specimens. If there are so many individuals that want to be tested and there's only so many people who can actually collect the specimen, again, you have to think about how we want to use those resources. Our healthcare industry only has so much throughput. It's not just the availability of the test. It's the whole infrastructure.
Yeah.
And additionally, when you come into a doctor's office or something like that, you know, you could be exposing others there.
Right. I think a lot of us are now realizing where the inadequacies are when it comes to the public health system right now in the United States. And some of us are looking at South Korea, which has these famous drive-through screening stations where people can check if they're infected and not leave their car, so they're not infecting anyone in a doctor's office or a hospital. Do you think that that is something that the United States should look into providing?
People should recognize that public health is there protecting the health of Americans 24/7. And it is very hard when you have been in an environment where public health has been defunded consistently to then ensure that you have enough resources immediately on hand to be able to respond to something like COVID-19, which moves through the population with speed and intensity. I do think there are opportunities for us to increase the testing throughput, and that's something that public health is actively working on. In addition, we do have private healthcare now that has the test available, and I know that they will be working in conjunction with public health to bring more testing online and make more available. But again, our private sector healthcare also has only so many resources.
Janet Hamilton is Senior Director of Policy and Science at the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists. Janet Hamilton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, some TV and film productions are shutting down because of COVID-19. Premieres are being postponed, film festivals. What this all means for the entertainment industry, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson say they have tested positive for COVID-19. They're both in Australia, where Hanks was set to film a movie about the life of Elvis Presley. Well, that production has now been halted, the latest of many put on hold in Hollywood because of this virus. Joining me to talk about that is Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Hey there.
Hey.
Well, let's begin with Tom Hanks. Everyone loves him. So what has the response been to his announcement?
Well, obviously, it shakes people when Tom Hanks, of all people, tests positive for this and is sick. Somebody was pointing out that TV show, I think it was called The Last Man on Earth, was about a virus that wipes out the world. And in that TV show, Tom Hanks is the first person to go from the virus
in
the fictional world, which feels a little, just an odd observation. But obviously, Tom Hanks shakes people.
Yeah, absolutely. And shakes Hollywood because they halted this production. So that means a bunch of people are out of work. And what does it mean for a ripple effect for other productions? Are they looking at that and saying, okay, we better stop production too? Or are they waiting until someone tests positive on their sets?
Some have already stopped. The morning show stopped production. This is like herding cats right now. I was just sitting in the edit meeting at the Hollywood Reporter, and the different things that people are trying to track about what is shutting down, what movies are postponed, what are the larger implications? You know, the television upfronts a little while ago, Viacom CBS canceled their event that's normally held in May in Carnegie Hall. And they're going to do some kind of video presentation. And that is not there. I'm sure others will follow. But so it's really very difficult to keep track of what is on and what is not on right now.
Although the governor here in California, Newsom, he recommended canceling gatherings of 250 people or more until at least through the end of the month. So I guess that would include big movie sets or TV sets and big movie premieres.
Well, some premieres have happened this past week. Mulan went forward on Monday, although everybody is watching to see whether it, you know, gets moved, because it's a huge movie in China, and China is not a place where people are going to the movies at this point. The Bloodshot premiere, which is a Vin Diesel thing, I think, that was held Tuesday night. And then other things are not happening. So you were seeing the new, the Universal just said the Fast and Furious 9th installment, which was supposed to open in the weeks ahead, is going to be pushed by a year. Bond has been pushed. This is very expensive, by the way. Quiet Place 2, Paramount had to push it. They've spent millions, and I mean tens of millions, on advertising already in some cases. And I don't know how, you know, they're not going to be able to recapture that. It's creating havoc with the entertainment industry, just like it is with all, you know, almost every industry. I think Netflix is the one company that's kind of sitting there thinking, well, people are going to be home. And it's Disney stock, on the other hand, you know, has been taking an immense beating.
Yeah, well, because not only do they have movies, they have cruise ships and amusement parks.
Yes, Disney with movies, hotels, cruise ships, they are seen as hugely vulnerable. And you may recall Bob Iger very abruptly stepped down as CEO a couple of weeks ago. The stock was at 125, and it was in the 90s earlier today. I haven't looked in the last few minutes, but it's getting clobbered.
So is there any way to help out people who may be laid off from a production for a while? Is there any fund or anything? Do the unions step in to help people who are below the line in any way if they don't have a financial cushion?
I think this is going to be a huge policy question, which hopefully people can sort out, because there are very, very vulnerable people. I mean, one of the great sins, in my opinion, of the entertainment industry is the number of people who are essentially full-time employees but treated as contractors. And so they don't get benefits at all. And there's no idea, there's no paid sick leave. And this is the kind of hazard, of course, that, you know, various people have been talking about, in that those are people who may go to work sick. Those are people who may not be able to afford, or not even, I mean, if they could get access to a test, which is another huge question, may not go and get tested. So, you know, this is a situation where there's going to be, of course, a lot of people very vulnerable and concerned. And I don't know how we're going to resolve it, because we're sort of in the middle of unfolding crisis right now, unfortunately.
Right. And then aside from the productions being canceled and all that, there are all the festivals being canceled. We've been talking about South by Southwest and Coachella, but, you know, there's upcoming, there's Cannes, there's Tribeca. And I'm guessing those things might be put on hold soon enough. What does that mean for filmmakers?
Well, if people are, of course, you know, it's there. If you've really worked to get your film out and your premiere is canceled, it's personally heartbreaking. Obviously, people know there are health risks, and they get it. But it is devastating, and financially devastating. You know, I saw this thing about a bakery in Austin, Texas, that had made all of these cookies, thousands and thousands, of anticipating huge business from the festival, just to show you the ripple effect of something like that. And they were online begging people to order the cookies because they want to stay in business. So yes, the entertainment business, there have been many studies showing, especially, you know, here in LA, what the value of that is to the economy in terms of ancillary businesses, and we're going to be feeling it, and it's going to be a very tough situation for a lot of people. I hope that we can get to the other side of it, you know, because obviously this is life and death for some people, and financially devastating for others.
Kim Masters is editor at large at The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Kim, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, restaurants are being affected too. How the owners of Chinese and Korean restaurants are reacting to a big downturn in business.
I know one of the restaurants specifically even went to the length of doing a full hazmat style cleaning of their restaurant.
How a false rumor led to empty restaurants in Koreatown. That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, restaurants in LA's Koreatown and in the San Gabriel Valley are seeing big declines in customers since the outbreak of COVID-19. Eater is reporting 30 to 70% drops in business at some Chinese restaurants. That's according to the restaurants they've spoken to. As for Koreatown, a single rumor spread online and targeted 5 Korean restaurants for having been exposed to someone with COVID-19. And that turned out to be a false rumor. Here to tell me about this is Matthew Kang, editor of Eater LA. Hi.
Hello.
Well, first, let's start with that rumor. What was it?
Yeah, so the rumor came out about 2 weeks ago on social media, mainly on Instagram, and specifically on a South Korean-based chat service called KakaoTalk, which is also very popular among Korean-Americans here in Los Angeles. And essentially what it was an anonymous black panel with some writing on it that said that the alleged Korean Airlines flight attendant who was in Los Angeles and had novel coronavirus, traveled to a number of restaurants, specifically, I actually won't even say their name, mm-hmm. but specifically named 5 restaurants in LA's Koreatown. Now, the rumor spread like wildfire amongst the Korean-American community. At a certain point, virtually everyone in the Korean-American community knew about the rumor and was suggesting to their friends and family not to visit not just these restaurants, but Koreatown as a whole.
Wow. So what happened to those restaurants?
Well, these restaurants, the sales at these restaurants plummeted. I heard anecdotally that one of the restaurants named had virtually no customers shortly after the rumor, and the only customers in them were non-Korean, perhaps because they hadn't heard of the rumor quite yet. Mm-hmm. But effects of that have just been devastating for not just the restaurant's name, but also a lot of other restaurants in Koreatown. I know one of the restaurants specifically even went to the length of doing a full hazmat style cleaning of their restaurant, of the dining room, not by any necessary, recommendation from the health department, but just because they wanted to somehow prove that they were a safe place to eat.
So there's a travel ban from South Korea as well as China. So it would be difficult at this point for someone who has it, who is there in one of those affected countries, to bring it here and infect a restaurant. But is that still on the minds of people when they decide to go out to eat? Are they avoiding Chinese and Korean restaurants?
Yeah, I do think that because of the initial news coming from China and then quickly spreading to South Korea, I think there's been a more immediate effect to Korean and especially Chinese restaurants. Yesterday, we published an article discussing the immediate effects to restaurants in San Gabriel Valley, which is the largest Asian American community in the Southern California area. We reported on specifically 3 restaurants that closed, 2 of which were temporary, 1 of which was a permanent closure. And you're starting to see reports of restaurants in San Gabriel Valley losing business upwards of 70%. We're talking about restaurants that had 1 to 2 hour long waits, and now their dining rooms are barely occupied. Anybody, if they wanted to go, could just walk in.
So these restaurant owners must be panicked that they're going to all go out of business.
I mean, the restaurant business is historically one of very thin and very low margin. There's not a lot of room for hiccups like this. And this is not just a hiccup. This is a major crisis for restaurants who are dealing with substantially lower sales, who are dealing with having to weigh whether or not to stay open. A lot of restaurants, especially mom and pop restaurants, they want to stay open as long as possible in order to keep their employees paid and allow for just people to maintain their jobs. Mm-hmm. But at this point, they have to have a difficult decision on whether or not they're going to stay open, whether or not they can continue to pay their employees. And yes, there's definitely a high level of concern, especially for Chinese restaurants. And I think it's been a difficult thing for them. The Chinese restaurants in particular have had to deal with reduced sales for months now, which is different than the Koreatown situation, which I think has been in the 1 to 2 to 3 week situation with, mm-hmm. with reduced sales.
I'm wondering, when it comes to Chinese restaurants, how much of it has to do with racism? Initially, we heard those accounts, but or is it just people now not wanting to leave their homes?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I think in other cities such as San Francisco or New York City, you're getting Chinatowns who are hit very hard because of tourists and, I would say, non-Chinese diners. In Los Angeles, it's a little bit of a different story. I've been told that in Koreatown and in San Gabriel Valley, much of the clientele is Korean or Chinese, respectively. And those populations are the ones that are avoiding these restaurants. A lot of times, restaurants that have sort of a mixed clientele, specifically one called Beer Garden in Koreatown, they haven't had as much of a significant hit in sales because they have both Korean and non-Korean clients. Whereas in restaurants that have a mainly Korean diner base, those are the ones that have been hit harder. I think it's the Korean community specifically that have, you know, where the word got around. They're the ones that are staying away from the restaurants because of sort of a, there's mm-hmm. just more of a cohesive action there. And also in San Gabriel Valley, a lot of these restaurants were heavily frequented by the local Asian population, Chinese population, and they are the ones specifically that are, you know, reducing their frequency of visits.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Matthew Kang, editor of Eater LA. Well, a lot of us are preparing for the possibility we may have to self-isolate for up to 2 weeks if we're exposed. And while it's a good thing to stock up on things like toilet paper, soap, Purell, paper towels, you will also need to eat, ideally more than peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and rice and beans. Here to talk about pantry staples worth stocking up on is David Tamarkin, editor for the food website Epicurious. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So we've seen people in the grocery store just clearing out shelves for an emergency. What should they be doing with that food?
You should be saving it. You should not be eating it. Take that food, put it in a place, you know, in your home where you won't really touch it until you absolutely need to. A 2 week, or if you can do it, 3 week reserve of food really should be reserved for emergencies. So don't touch it now, but it is good to plan for it.
Okay, so don't touch it. What should we be buying for reserves that we're not going to touch?
I think there are a couple different levels. When I think of a pantry, I think of two places. I think of a cupboard, you know, where I can keep dry goods, and I think of my freezer. Now, for the pantry, I'm definitely thinking beans because I'm obsessed with beans. I'm thinking both dried beans and canned beans. Those, to me, are some of the most versatile foods you can have, and they're, you know, excellent nutritionally. I'm definitely thinking tomatoes for all sorts of reasons, for making shakshuka or, you know, pasta sauce. And speaking of pasta, I'm thinking of pasta. I think there's going to be a lot of pantry pasta in our futures, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I eat a lot of pantry pasta anyway.
What is pantry pasta versus non-pantry pasta?
Yeah, well, pantry pasta is just something that you can make with things that are you have on hand. And it's sort of interesting to talk about this because when we're putting out recipes for pantry pastas, we're putting out a lot of caveats. Like, well, if you have fresh herbs still in your fridge that you can use, you know, throw those in. If you have onions and garlic, you know, throw those in. Those aren't necessarily pantry ingredients, but they're things that you might have left over, you know, from your normal everyday cooking and eating. And also there's plenty of shelf-stable cured meats that you could slice and crisp up in a skillet and put into a pasta. Basically, if it's sold at room temperature, if you pick it up at room temperature in the grocery store, it'll stay at room temperature in your house for a good amount of time.
Like forever? Or is there a shelf? Is there an end date?
I don't know. The only thing I know that lasts forever is honey. Honey that has absolutely no expiration date. There's honey in the tombs in Egypt, and that was still good. So I would not say it lasts forever, but certainly a dried cured meat, I think, can last, you know, a good few weeks, you know, I would say 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's what's in your cupboard. You're talking about dry pasta, beans, canned and dried, tomatoes, fish, like tuna, anchovies, sardines, yep. That kind of thing.
Tin fish. I would also add coconut milk in there.
Because it's tasty and can be a good
sauce. Yeah, because it's good for so many things. I mean, I go through a couple cans of coconut milk a week at this point when I'm making curries or, you know, making smoothies if you're a smoothie person. As a cook and as someone who is like really invested, maybe too invested in the food I eat, I'm particularly concerned about having variety. I think this can be a stressful time. You know, I've already started to self-isolate a little bit, and I'm concerned about, you know, having variety just to kind of lift my spirits. So I want to have coconut milk in addition to shelf-stable milk, in addition to maybe shelf-stable soy milk on hand so that I don't get bored. I mean, I could get the same things and, you know, make the same pantry pasta day in and day out, but I am hoping for a little variety. Obviously, that's not the top concern, but if you are privileged enough to think that way, I think it's helpful.
Okay, so that's in your cupboard. What about your freezer?
For the freezer, I'm obviously thinking frozen vegetables. I'm going to pack my freezer with lots of greens. I'm going to do maybe frozen corn, frozen peas for sure. And I'm also going to keep my bread in the freezer. I'm a carbs guy. I need carbs. So I'm going to get fresh bread. I'm going to slice it, and I'm going to stick it in my freezer, where obviously it will keep much longer than if it's just sitting on my countertop. Another thing I'm going to keep in my freezer is fruit for smoothies or for turning into, you know, sauces I can put on ice cream. Ice cream is another thing I'm going to keep in my freezer. but the freezer for me is the place where I'm really going to get my greens. The thing that concerns me the most about an emergency reserve of food is where am I going to get my vegetables and where am I going to get my green food? So one thing I'm going to do is if I get a heads up that I'm going to be in isolation for a couple weeks, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to blend any herb I have in my fridge, whether that's parsley, mint, cilantro, dill. I'll put them all together in a blender with garlic and olive oil and salt, and I'll create like a pesto-like sauce. And then I'll freeze that. And maybe I'll freeze it in my ice cube tray. I can't believe I'm actually saying that because I think that's – I always roll my eyes when people say,
I'm rolling them right now.
Yes, well, I know it sounds ridiculous, and I've never done it before, but I will say this. I do often make green sauces, and I keep them in my fridge, and I find them absolutely invaluable for, you know, if all I have in the house is chickpeas, which is a very real possibility if we're, you know, talking about an emergency reserve, to be able to put something fresh and green and vibrant on the chickpeas is important, and it's important for flavor. Visually, it's important. It just helps make the food a lot less sad.
So those are things you buy in a bag, right?
I mean, you could buy fresh kale and prep it, put it in the freezer, especially if you're buying it at the grocery store, you know, greens that are meant to be frozen. I would keep that around for at least 3 months.
And then I guess if you're super desperate, or if you just want some variety, you could Postmates it.
I guess you could, assuming that Postmates still exist. I guess you could, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's David Tamarkin, editor for the food website Epicurious. We reached him at his home where he is self-isolating. David, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, reaction to President Trump's ban on European travelers for 30 days. We'll go to Europe next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, last night, President Trump announced the U.S. would suspend all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days.
The new rules will go into effect Friday at midnight. These restrictions will be adjusted subject to conditions on the ground. There will be exemptions for Americans who have undergone appropriate screenings.
Well, meanwhile, in Europe, French President Emmanuel Macron just announced that starting Monday, all daycare, schools and universities will be closed across France. We're going to check back in now with Rachel Donadio. She's a contributing writer for The Atlantic, and she joined us earlier this week to talk about Italy. Now we're going to expand that conversation. Hi there.
Hi, nice to talk to you again.
Nice to have you back, although I didn't know it would be so soon. Anyway, I'm delighted to have you. What's happening in France? You've been following Macron's announcement, which he just gave.
Yeah, this is spreading like the virus, the response. So President Emmanuel Macron just announced on a live television address that France would close all schools from daycares up to universities starting on Monday until further notice, and that people across the entire country are strongly advised to work from home if at all possible. They can still circulate, but really they should work from home if possible. He also said that there would be no penalties if you miss your March tax payments. And he said that they would, you know, they know this would be a big sacrifice, but they would have to shut down different gatherings. So probably no theaters, no cinemas, no gatherings like that. He told people over the age of 70 and anyone with respiratory problems or other pre-existing conditions to stay home, just stay home. And public transportation would still work, but you should take it at your own caution. Really, it was a similar message to the one in Italy to stay home. But unlike in Italy, where you're really required by law to not leave home, in France, it's strongly suggested. He also said that France would increase the hospital capacities to deal with patients coming in with this dreadful disease who sometimes require ICU care and respiratory support.
And what is the situation in France with the cases and the deaths? I know it's not as serious at all as Italy's situation, but is it still pretty serious there?
Yeah, the numbers of cases and deaths are rising. I mean, this is an exponential rise, and you just can't fight that. France has significantly fewer numbers of cases than Italy, but again, it's a number that rises exponentially every day. So really, the intention is to take these measures to prevent the spread of it and to prevent the hospital system from becoming overwhelmed. But France has, you know, Italy has over 10,000 cases now, and France has more like between 1 and 2,000 the last that I checked. But still, the number is increasing.
Yeah, so it's definitely worrisome. Also worrisome today was the situation at Charles de Gaulle this morning or earlier today as Americans were trying to get back to the United States. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people were crowding on flights. There have been some reports of, you know, price gouging, and then some of those reports were later refuted. But really, people are just trying to get the last flights out. You know, Trump's travel ban does not apply to American citizens who are allowed to leave Europe when they want. But it's still, you know, there was a kind of rush to get the last helicopter out of Saigon kind of atmosphere, although that's not great for the public health situation, because the point is you're supposed to stay 1 meter away, which is another thing I forgot to mention. President Macron says stay as far as possible away from other people, stay a meter away, do not shake hands, and do not kiss on both cheeks when you greet people. So, you know, the real headline, France banned the bees.
Oh, no, that is definitely right at the core of the French way of living. So I guess, yeah. So the airport's crowded with people trying to get back. That definitely they're not staying 1 meter apart in that situation. So what is the overall reaction in Europe to that travel ban? Because I think most of Europe was asleep when he made that announcement.
Yeah, he made the announcement around 2 a.m. Central European time, which is the time zone in France and Italy and Brussels, and it stunned a lot of European leaders. They say that they had not been consulted. So the European Union officials issued a statement saying that they disapproved of the fact and said that the decision was taken unilaterally without their consideration. And they said the coronavirus is a global crisis not limited to any continent, and it requires cooperation rather than unilateral action. So very much upset at this decision.
But this decision exempts the UK. And here's what Prime Minister Boris Johnson said today about what's happening in his country when it comes to COVID-19.
I've got to be clear. We've all got to be clear. This is the worst public health crisis for a generation. Some people compare it to seasonal flu. Alas, that is not right, owing to the lack of immunity, this disease is more dangerous.
Okay, so from the latest statistics that I have, there are 590 cases there, 10 deaths. Why was the UK exempted from this travel ban?
I think we don't entirely know for sure, but, you know, the UK left the European Union, and so maybe it's an award for Brexit, but I don't feel qualified to give a full answer on that, except to say that, you know, the UK is no longer part of Europe. That was the point of Brexit. Remember Brexit? That was a very big story before this pandemic hit.
Exactly. Okay, so getting back to Europe and to Italy in particular, which is really hard hit, more than 1,000 people dead, 15,000 plus infections. And these very draconian measures were implemented earlier, right? Movement limited to emergencies, shops closed, all of them except for pharmacies and grocery stores. How have Italians reacted to that?
They've reacted remarkably well in the sense that their entire lives have just kind of changed from one day to the next. I think that most people are accepting this with a sense of national sacrifice. There are examples of some people who've actually been arrested or stopped because you're really not supposed to be moving around unless you have a very good reason. Again, they can't enforce that entirely. There's been some restive situations in prisons in particular. There have been prison riots because prisoners are upset that they can't have in-person meetings with family members anymore. Some workers in some factories have been very upset that they have to, you know, they're allowed to go to work. And I think that they don't necessarily want to be doing that. I mean, they wonder what the health and safety conditions are for them. So sense of national sacrifice, kind of slow growing awareness that this is the new normal, but a little bit of restiveness here and there. In general, a very much, you know, in general, Italy has kind of stepped up.
And so are people obeying the rules? Are they staying indoors? And if even in you know, further south in places like Rome, is it pretty quiet?
It's ghostly. I mean, I've been looking at pictures and, you know, watching some images on TV. It's just there's no one around. If you're allowed to go out and to go to grocery stores, pharmacies, tobacconists, newsstands are still open, but you can't, all the other stores are closed. And there you have to stay 1 meter apart. So there are images of people waiting, you know, in line for things with a meter space between the next person in line. It's really uncanny.
Right. Now, Italy has one of the best healthcare systems in Europe. How is it coping with this huge influx of sick people?
Not particularly well. I mean, the reason why the country imposed these draconian measures is because Lombardy, the richest and most functional in some ways region in the country, or the area around Milan, was finding its healthcare system pushed to the brink. There were just too many people requiring ICU care, and healthcare workers have been working around the clock. It's really pushed things very, very far. There aren't enough spaces in the ICU for cases who don't have this virus. And now the fear is that it'll spread to the rest of the country where the healthcare system is much weaker and not as wealthy and well-staffed. This is the problem. It's not that everybody who gets this disease winds up in the ICU. It's just that a high percentage of them do, and it's just pushing the healthcare system to the brink. Again, in a country with a fairly functional public system.
Right. So reports of rationing care, I've read there is some of that going on.
Yeah, we have some sobering pieces in The Atlantic. I mean, doctors are told to treat this as a kind of wartime triage situation. You save the people you think can be saved, and you give them the ventilators if you don't have enough ventilators. These are heartbreaking, painful, Sophie's Choice-like decisions that many doctors have to be taking in Italy today.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for coming back on the show to update us what's happening in Italy and the rest of Europe. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on that happy note.
I know.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Be well. Rachel Donadio from The Atlantic reporting for us from Paris. And that'll do it for Press Play for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.